Our final argument for the Northern Nevada panel this year is case number 69878, Clough versus State. Mr. Domon for the appellant, Mr. Mills for the respondent. And there's no reply brief, so you can't reserve any time. You can use your whole 15 minutes. Enjoy yourself.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, I'm Benjamin Domon, Elko County Deputy Public Defender. I represent the interests of Tammy Clough. Now, the first issue on this appeal is whether or not the district court erred in denying Ms. Clough's motion to suppress as to the issue of reasonable suspicion for the traffic stop. Now, the district court denied the motion in that regard. Judge Kaysen said that Tyler Thomas, the officer in Carlin, had reasonable suspicion to detain Ms. Clough for driving without a valid license. That stop occurred on November 10th of 2014. Now, initially, at the preliminary hearing, which is on record with this court, that transcript, that is, the officer said that he knew a month prior to that date in question that Ms. Clough did not have a driver's license. And on cross-examination, however, his testimony seemed to unravel because defense counsel Roger Stewart, my coworker, asked, could have been over a month period of time between the time you verified Ms. Clough didn't have a driver's license and November 10th of 2014. His response verbatim at the preliminary hearing was, I have no idea. And Mr. Stewart, the defense counsel, asked, could have been 2 months prior to the November 10th stop. And Officer Thomas said, quote, it could have been, I'm not quite sure, I know I was. I frequented that house a lot. Then we get to district court, and that's where the suppression...
Frequented the house, meaning where your client lived, or is that what he was talking about?
That is accurate. He wasn't sure the exact nature of the encounter, but it wasn't a traffic stop in any event. Now we get to the suppression hearing in district court, where Officer Thomas verified that it was between 1 and 2 months between the time he knew Ms. Clough was not a licensed driver, and that was during that encounter at Ms. Clough's residence, and November 10th of 2014. Now, the state in defending Officer Thomas's actions cites Stewart versus State. That's a case out of Georgia. Now, I reviewed that case, and there's nowhere in there that states the precise measurement of time between the time the officer had known that Stewart didn't have a driver's license and the time of the traffic stop. Whereas in this case, the length of time between when Mr. Thomas knew Ms. Clough was not licensed and the time of the ultimate stop, that's obviously the big issue as to this issue. Now, the next state that the state cites is United States versus Pierre. I reviewed that case as well. That case is wholly distinguishable from Ms. Clough's case. And it is because Officer Murphy, in that case, had arranged it with fellow members of the vice squad. And this was a sting operation that lasted about 5 months in time. And the arrangement was, if officers of the vice squad were notified that Pierre had his license restored, that Officer Murphy would have been told about it. So Officer Murphy, in that case, had ongoing information to the effect that Pierre did not get his license back, and that information went into the period of time when Officer Murphy observed Pierre driving the automobile. Was that the case here? There's nothing in the record that says that Officer Thomas in the Carlin Police Department had arranged it with dispatch or anyone else in that regard to notify him when Ms. Clough gets her license back. So in that sense, Pierre is not really controlling here. Now, there's a third case that the state cites, and that is State versus Spillner. That's the case out of Hawaii from 9 years ago. Now, the officer in that case knew that about 1 or 2 weeks, not months, weeks before the stop, that Spillner, the appellee in that case, had no insurance and did not have a driver's license. So that's far less of a span of time than what we're dealing here with Ms. Clough. But the state, in citing that case, talks about bookends. What would be stale and what would be fresh information? And on one hand, one bookend, 22 days was deemed to be fresh information about one's driver's license status, whereas 22 weeks would be stale. So the problem with applying Spillner here is 30 to 60 days we're dealing with in this court. That's in between the bookends. Now, if this court were to apply Spillner, Spillner also dealt with the issue of considering how many prior contacts the officer had with the suspect, coupled with how much time elapsed between the last inquiry as to the license status and the ultimate time of the stop. So this court follows that. Is there going to be very clear standards for law enforcement to follow? We would argue no. There should be a clear standard, and the standard articulated in the fast track statement is that in this case, the officer should have made an attempt to check Ms. Clough's driver's license status while seeing her drive. There's certainly no impediment whatsoever for the officer doing that. Now, back to the state's fast track response. In its research, the state says that they were not able to find any case with regards to 1 or 2 months that span of time being stale. And I can report to the court that I did find such a case. It's out of Ohio. It's State versus Tackett. It's 524 Northeast 2nd, Reporter 536. That's a case from 1987. And that case actually hadn't been cited in either of the fast track filings. However, what that court said should be followed. What that court said is, quote, it would seem all the more persuasive that a court should not permit the deprivation of one's personal liberty on the basis of information, which is a month or more old, which is precisely what we have here. We have information that's a month or more old. And in deciding that case, that court said that there's many ways in which a driver's license can be restored to being active. It's important for me to emphasize that in this particular case, Ms. Clough didn't have a definite period of suspension. Had she been suspended for a year from the time that Officer Thomas did his last inquiry, this would be a non-issue. That's not the case. This was a suspension or a revocation. In any event, she had no license, but there was not a period of time where she was ineligible to get her driver's license. And in that case, and this is a case from way back in 1987, they talked about how there's modern technology and how it's not too much to ask for an officer to verify at the time of observing the suspect to observe their status as to whether or not at the time they're driving that they have a valid driver's license. So in sum, when we look at all the cases the state has cited, they haven't found a case that says a 30-day period of time is in fact fresh, not stale. The defense, on the other hand, has presented to this court the Tackett decision from Ohio. So between what the state has cited and what the defense has cited, clearly the persuasive authority is on the side of the defense and is not on the side of the state of Nevada. And that brings me to the second issue on this agenda. And that's this issue of the Intoxilizer 8000 checklist, about whether suppression is the proper remedy when we're dealing with an officer that not only did not follow the checklist that was in existence back on November 10th of 2014, but he intentionally did not follow it. Now, Mr. Stewart in my office cited Beavers versus DMV in the fast track statement. And in that case, the appellant, Ms. Beavers, complained that the 15-minute observation period wasn't observed. Apparently, she had some gum in her mouth. However, this court ruled in that case, this is from 1993, that there was a 15-minute observation period observed after the gum was removed from her mouth. And I stress the word after because in this case, we're not dealing with a 15-minute observation period after dentures are removed because this officer let this cloth put her dentures back in, which is clearly what the checklist does not allow. Any foreign object has to be out of the mouth, and then the 15-minute clock commences. Now, we contend that suppression was considered. I know it wasn't explicit in the court opinion. It was denied as a remedy. We believe that the court can look at the reasonableness of the search here, the search of Ms. Clough's breath with respect to whether or not he can, in fact, effectuate that search without having properly followed the instructions in the checklist. So at the heart of suppression is there any kind of wrongful conduct here? We believe there is wrongful conduct that must be deterred, because here the officer was told the dentures must come off. So what does Mr. Thomas do? Lets her rinse the dentures out and lets her put it back in, observes her for at least 15 minutes after the dentures are put back in. Clearly, that is in violation of the checklist that's in place. And there's no dispute that that's the checklist that applied. That doesn't appear to be a dispute at all in this case. And it's the kind of conduct that must be deterred. Why? Because the administrative code at issue is 484C.130. That administrative code that was promulgated says that officers shall use and follow those instructions in the checklist. It does not give Officer Tyler Thomas the option. If this code means anything and is truly in effect in this state, it should be applied to not allow the admissibility of these results when an officer doesn't follow the instructions. Plus, in this case, you have the extra element of wrongfulness. And there is an issue of scienter here because he didn't follow the rules. In fact, he even signed the checklist saying that he followed the rules, which means by signing it, he said that he had Ms. Clough remove foreign objects, which clearly is a false statement. Now, what the state did in the lower court is continuing this argument in this court is that what Officer Thomas did was scientifically appropriate. We had the criminalist Stephen Johnson testify in district court. Mr. Johnson testified that checklist was in place. That was not disputed by the state. Of course, it wasn't disputed by the defense either. And Mr. Johnson said that what Mr. Thomas did was scientifically sound, that by waiting those 15 minutes, that it gave time for the alcohol to dissipate from Ms. Clough's mouth. Well, I'm here to argue the law. I'm no scientist, but we have to deal with the issue of whether or not we can send the message to law enforcement in this state that they can not only disregard a checklist, but disregard the administrative code. And that would be a bad precedent to set in this state. The question that I advance is, does it make it any less wrongful what Mr. Thomas did because the end result may have been right? And we'd argue that no. On one hand, we have this issue of science and whether or not the result is scientifically accurate, coupled with Officer Thomas, who violated the administrative code and falsely stated that he followed the checklist. I would argue it is very important that officers follow the administrative code. It's not too much to ask them to follow that. So what we ask is that, applied to the facts of this case, that this court overturned Judge Kaysen's determination with regards to the issue that this breathalyzer result was proper because it was scientifically. Judge Kaysen didn't really scratch the surface of this issue of scienter here, and I'm hoping that this court addresses that, because that is certainly an issue in this case. Whatever Mr. Johnson says about the scientific accuracy of what the officer did, the bottom line is that checklist existed in November 10th of 2014 that required Officer Thomas to follow the checklist, and nothing that Mr. Johnson can say about how the checklist changed after the fact, that doesn't undo the wrongfulness. The wrongful conduct, the nature of that can't be undone by what has been done later by Stephen Johnson and other scientists that have researched this issue regarding the scientific accuracy of having one submit to an intoxilizer whilst either wearing dentures or having any other foreign object in his or her mouth. We believe suppression is appropriate, and we ask that the court overturn the lower court decision.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mills of the state of Nevada?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mark Mills, and I represent the respondent, the state of Nevada, in this case. And as your honors are aware, there are two issues in this case. The first issue is whether Officer Tyler Thomas, on November 10th, 2014, when he conducted a traffic stop on the appellant, Tammy Clough, whether he had reasonable suspicion to do so based on prior information that he had that she did not have a valid driver's license. The second issue is whether the procedures that he used in administering the intoxilizer exam were such that it would warrant suppression or exclusion of the breath results. With regards to the first issue, counsel for the respondent believes that there was reasonable suspicion and believes that Pierre, you know, like the district court, is a really compelling case as far as that argument goes. There are quite a few cases that have addressed this issue. This, of course, is an issue of first impression for the state of Nevada. But three federal circuit courts of appeals have addressed the issue, including the Pierre case relied upon by the state, the Laughlin case relied upon by the appellant. And there's a third case that's referenced in that Spillner case. It's the 22-day end of the bookend referenced by Spillner. That's a third case, Sandridge, another federal circuit court of appeals case, which also upheld a stop based on an officer's prior knowledge of that a person did not have a valid license.
How recent was Officer Thomas's information that Ms. Clough didn't have a valid driver's license prior to the time of the stop here in this case?
Okay. So initially at the preliminary hearing, he testified. I asked him that question, and he stated within the past 30 days. On cross-examination, he was pressed about that, and this is kind of a factual dispute to some degree, because he conceded that it could have been as great as 60 days or a couple of months. And then at the hearing on the motion to suppress, he kind of reiterated that 30 to 60-day range, and that's ultimately the finding of fact that was made by the district court, that the stop occurred within 30 to 60 days prior to the prior contact in which she was informed that she didn't have a valid license occurred within 30 to 60 days of November 10th in this case.
Well, I was interested because the United States versus Loughran talked about 5 months being too long.
Yes.
You know, like that. So your position is 30 to 60 is close enough.
Closer to the other bookend, right? So when Spillner, it talks about the two federal circuit courts of appeals, Loughran on the one hand, which is 5 months, and then Sandridge on the other hand, which is 22 days. That's the 22 days versus 22 weeks. And I would submit that this case is much closer to the 22 days. And direct the court's attention to the third federal case, which is Pierre, which even makes it even more compelling that the stop was reasonable in this case. Because if you look at the facts of Pierre, that officer, over a period of about a year, September 2009 to September 2010, he worked in a narcotics unit. And during that time, he had acquired knowledge that Pierre did not have a valid license. And not only didn't have a valid license, but just hadn't even been driving a vehicle, just the simple fact that he didn't have a valid license.
How do you respond to the case that was raised on the reasonableness of this stop when they could have called in to see if there was a license in this case? There's nothing that stated that it was exigent, any type of emergency where they had to stop her right away. They couldn't have got on the radio and said, check this person for license.
My response to that would be that even if the officer could have done that, it's not constitutionally mandated.
Well, but we're in this thing of trying to define this area of what is reasonableness. And as you said, we have this great big window or sea of what is reasonable. We're trying to narrow down and put some parameters on.
I'd like to tell you that courts have found that is reasonable to not call it in and confirm before pulling him over. So I would direct the court's attention to Sandridge, the case I just mentioned. In that case, that was
an officer who seems to be vacillating between 30 and 60 days, and he has this technology at his disposal, and he chooses for whatever reason not to use it, but he's not sure if it's 30 to 60 days. He's not sure if it's a suspension where the person can't be reinstated, or in fact, if it's just something where they need just to go down and reapply for a license. So I'm having trouble trying to put this term reasonable suspicion in context here.
Well, reasonable suspicion is based on specific articulable facts. And in this case, the specific and articulable facts that Officer Thomas had were that he had known this person for 3.5 years, and that's an important factual finding by the district court as well, that he knew her for a long period of time.
But he has this vagueness of, I'm not sure 30 to 60 days my last inference or information, this person allegedly didn't have a license. Is that reasonable? That's what I'm trying to come down to. And what steps should this person take, officer, before he asserts himself into someone's life? We don't have any information that they were, in fact, violating traffic law at the time of this stop or anything else that would make one want to query the individual, except for just the fact, I know this person. That always gives me pause.
Well, it wasn't just the simple fact that he knew the person. It was that he knew the person and for a continuing status of 3 years where repeatedly he checked her license and found that it was invalid. That's 3 years worth of information that he had.
But it begs the question, if she wasn't in a situation where it was a major impediment about getting a license, like too many DUIs or something, she could have gone any time and gotten a valid license.
Okay. Well, the courts haven't imposed that kind of high bar. It's reasonable suspicion isn't beyond a reasonable doubt. It's not probable cause even, if whether he has specific articulable facts. And in this case, we believe that he does. There's a court that...
Articulable facts, and that comes back another term. You're using that term of art, facts. So what are the specific facts? Had that person himself verified, or was the information only, I hate to use the term, hearsay information, he was told?
Well, it's always going to be hearsay in all of these cases. And for purposes of formulating reasonable suspicion or probable cause, an officer is always going to rely upon, hey, dispatch told me this, or so-and-so told me this. That's always...
But that word you just used, I guess it comes back to my question, which you were evading at one point, was dispatch. He could have asked dispatch.
Yeah.
And he chose not to, but you say he was relying on potentially dispatch. So why is it not good? If it's good for one, why is it not good for another?
Well, courts haven't imposed that requirement. I'll quote to you, contrary to defendant's assertions, the officer had no constitutional obligation to verify the status of the defendant's license before making the stop. Indeed, the availability of less intrusive investigatory...
I beg to differ with that statement, because you do have a right to travel. You have a right not to be just stopped unreasonably. And so that brings us back to this, what is the reasonableness to allow you to stop with those constitutional provisions? Because what you just said, I will disagree every day that you do have a basic right to travel. So then we have to get down to what allows you to invade that constitutional right.
I understand your concern, but the cases have not held that there is a requirement to check with dispatch before pulling someone over. They've held that the officer's knowledge is sufficient reasonable suspicion.
Well, cases have held just because there's a general warrant for a dangerous person in a red car, you're not able to stop every red car on the highway. That starts bothering me, that you're just giving indiscriminate right of an officer to stop anyone for any reason. That's problematic.
I had a question too. Judge Kasin did it's about an 8-page order with a 9th page on it for service and all, but he makes some factual conclusions and legal conclusions in there. Should our standard review be abuse of discretion, or is it de novo because there's legal issues here? What's your position on that?
The appellate court's review of a trial court's determination of a motion to suppress, with regards to that, you review the factual findings for clear error and review the legal conclusions de novo. And so, yeah, those findings of fact, and the district court did a good job of laying those out, this court is to give deference to and review for clear error. The legal conclusions, you review de novo, of course.
Okay. And I know you're going to get to the second issue here. I just have a question leading sure. into it like that. I think Mr. Gamon's kind of arguing like a strict compliance with the checklist requirement under the administrative code. Should it be a strict compliance or substantial compliance, or how do we deal with that, considering every person that's stopped is probably has different physical issues and all to deal with? You know, what's the state's position on that?
Well, substantial compliance. In fact, I think there's a statute that addresses that as far as it's NRS 484C 240 talks about a court shall not exclude the evidence if the officer substantially complies with the provisions of the
DOJ. What was the statute again? I'm sorry.
It's 44C.240.
What's the first part? I couldn't hear. I apologize.
NRS 484C.240.
Okay.
Yeah. But in any event, in this case, I think it's a misrepresentation to say that there was wrongfulness and that he disregarded the checklist. If you look at the checklist, he actually complied with everything on there.
What about this denture situation?
Yeah, what he did is he went kind of above and beyond that and added a couple of things to it. So it's not that he failed to comply with anything that was on there, but he had her rinse out her mouth, which wasn't on the checklist, and he had her rinse out the dentures and put them back in. So, and the testimony of Stephen Johnson, who's the guy who calibrates all these machines in Nevada, or at least northern Nevada, and who trains the officers in the academy on this, he came in at the suppression hearing and testified that that's a good practice because it eliminates the residual alcohol, and that he had no concerns about the validity of the results or the scientific, he said it was scientifically sound is the phrase he used. And really, we're not even talking about a constitutional issue here, as the district court pointed out, that there isn't really a constitutional violation, so the suppression isn't at issue unless there's a specific statute on point that would authorize it.
I don't think it's inhumane for an officer to allow somebody to put their dentures back in. I think that most people, if they have dentures, luckily I don't yet. time will tell. I don't think that we can fault an officer for allowing somebody to put their dentures back in.
Yeah, so I would direct the court's attention to the district court's findings of facts with regards to the testimony of Stephen Johnson. It's very persuasive. He said, I have no concerns about this. This is just fine. It's scientifically sound. There's some checks as well in the machine and process, built into the process and the machine itself. If the samples aren't within 0.02 of each other, the results aren't valid. Or it would be evidence that there's residual alcohol in the mouth. The 15-minute waiting period, which was complied with. He testified it takes 11 to 12 minutes for alcohol to dissipate within the mouth, so that's a check. So he had no concerns. I've got a couple minutes left. If I could go back to the first issue and make just a couple of final points about that, unless there's some additional questions about the second issue. Okay. So just with regards to the stop based on reasonable suspicion, there's a couple of points that I really want to emphasize. Again, going back to Pierre, if you look at the facts of that case, there was a 5-month break in time between the last time the officer had obtained awareness that the person did not have a valid license. It was September of 2010. February 21st is when he effected a traffic stop based on that knowledge. And it was about a year's worth of knowledge of the ongoing status of the person without a license. And the Pierre Circuit Court of Appeals upheld that. And in fact, you know, he didn't run a check prior to pulling him over to address your concern. The officer in that case didn't do it. In Sanders, it was brought up actually in the opinion itself in that circuit court of appeals, and the court wasn't concerned about that issue. And just one final point, that in all of these things, there's kind of a two-step, and by these things I mean motions to suppress or requests to suppress evidence based on constitutional grounds. It's always a two-step process. One, you decide whether a constitutional violation has occurred, but then that's not the end of the hunt. There has to be an independent determination about whether exclusion is warranted given the constitutional violation. So I would submit for the reasons raised that there hasn't been a constitutional violation, but even if there is, it doesn't rise to the level that would require exclusion. The U.S. Supreme Court has repeatedly hammered home that point in recent years, most notably in Herring, where they said exclusion is a last resort, not a first impulse, and it's only warranted in instances of the most flagrant and purposeful conduct. And this is an issue of first impression for this court, so it cannot be said that this was flagrant conduct on the part of Officer Thomas when there hasn't been a Supreme Court case yet addressing this issue within this jurisdiction. And the cases outside of this jurisdiction, many of them, factually similar to this one, have said, yeah, that's reasonable suspicion. You can pull someone over based on prior knowledge that you have that the person doesn't have a valid license. I think I'm out of time. Are there any other questions for the court?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Court thanks both of you for your arguments and briefs in this matter. And this matter will stand submitted. And I just wanted to inquire, did both of you drive in from Elko today? Or did you?
No, I'm driving to the airport.
Yeah, I drove in yesterday, but we'll be returning either today or tomorrow, depending on the weather.
Well, we just want you, both Justice and Terry and I have visited Carlin. We've been to the court there. We've been to Carlin, so we got an understanding of the community. And I think we visited just about all the small communities in Elko County, so we're getting around. I like it.
Sounds like you're well traveled.
We want Justice Douglas to come with us the next.
Well, it was just out there 2 weeks.
Yeah, that's right. He was in Elko.
Justice Gibbons came up with the idea of doing cases in the high schools, and we've been to all over. You name a court, and we've been there. And we usually go to the high schools, and we have actual court cases. And the attorneys love it, by the way.
And we have been to Elko High School and West Wendover High School.
Right. Winnemucca twice.
They have not been to Jack.
You know high school.
I've been to Jackpot a couple times.
Thank you for coming in.
Thank you. Have a nice day.
We'll be in recess.